Members of the Native Hawaiian community are rallying on various islands today. It's in response to a court case of a Maui professor who asked for a Hawaiian interpreter. One was provided for his initial court appearance, but he was found to be in contempt of court after a court judge ruled his trial would be in English. That touched off a firestorm. The judiciary said yesterday it's reviewing its policies. Now, HPR's Kuvehi Arishi has been tracking the story and joins us live in the studio with the latest. Morning, Kuvehi.
Aloha, Catherine.
Now, the judiciary didn't really explain why they pulled back on the bench warrant, correct?
Yeah, there was no explanation in that statement, but it was issued an interesting 24 hours later where they recalled the bench warrant and then said in there that they will be scheduling a future hearing on whether or not he should have a Hawaiian language interpreter.
Right, and you had reported that I think OHA was being very vocal about the sensitivity of this issue because there was a time when it was illegal to speak Hawaiian here.
Yeah, I think it really touched on a lot of the Hawaiian language speaking community's heartstrings on this one because it did bring us back to that time where it was prohibited, where you were punished for speaking the Hawaiian language. So OHA, the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, did send out a statement. The Native Hawaiian Legal Corps sent out a statement. Everybody was getting on board and sort of, they were really touched by what happened.
Right. And then we've got rallies going on today. Tell us about that.
We do. We have rallies here on Oahu at the Hawaii Supreme Court scheduled for 3 to 5. Also in Maui where it happened in front of the Wailuku Courthouse. And then I've seen notices for one in Kaneohe and also on the Big Island in Hilo. So folks are, I think that what's happening is the Hawaiian language revitalization movement has really made a lot of strides in the last 30 years, at least in for those who are in the community, that's what was seen as our language is alive. We hear it everywhere. We see it. There are a lot of Hawaiian speakers in various industries. So when we all saw this video, and folks may have seen it, of Kalei Kuaka'eo, the University of Hawaii Maui professor, standing up in court, introducing himself in Hawaiian, but being essentially ignored by the judge and the prosecutor, and then a bench warrant being issued for failure to not appear, it really was shocking for a lot of folks because they felt we had made so many strides in revitalizing the language that we get to this point where it's actually not recognized in a court of law. So very, I think, something that's really activated the Hawaiian language community.
Right. And there are legal issues and, you know, lawyers and judges are guided by, you know, what does the law provide? And, of course, there is a cultural sensitivity being that Hawaiian and English are the two official languages here.
Right. So in 1978, the Hawaiian language was made an official language. But I think at the time, a lot of folks were wanting more. They wanted a proviso element to it, having to mandate some of that. So I think that's what we're seeing now is that they want the Hawaiian language community is looking for more bite to that. They don't want it to be purely symbolical in that, yes, we have Hawaiian language recognized. We want it to be mandated. And so the issue of a court interpreter is interesting because when in speaking to the judiciary, the current policy is that there is no legal requirement to provide an interpreter for someone who speaks English. And that's the case in this situation with a lot of folks who speak Hawaiian nowadays is that they are also fluent in English. And so that's what the motion that was filed by the prosecution in this particular case had argued that he can speak English. It would be impractical for us and an unnecessary expense to have to bring in an interpreter when he can just speak English. So I think that's that is the policy that I believe the judiciary is going to be looking at. And I think a lot of legislators, it really got their attention and they're trying to figure out how to add some bite to that idea that Hawaiian language is an official language of the state.
Do you know specifically what some of these lawmakers are thinking about as far as legislation?
I did not see anything introduced just yet. I did hear a lot from Representative Andrea Tupola and a representative from Maui, Kaniela Ng, saying they're trying to look at the laws behind this and figure out what they can do. In the past, we have heard from Senator Kalani English over on Maui consistently for the last 6 years trying to pass legislation to mandate that legal documents at the legislature be done in Hawaiian and English. So something along those lines where it has some meat or substance behind just this idea that it's an official language.
Right. So it's obviously kind of taken off the scab off of an old wound. And I think that's what probably we're going to hear about at these rallies across the state today.
I definitely think so, Catherine.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us this morning. And I'm sure you'll be on top of this.
I will.
Going forward. Thank you.
Thank you.
Kuvehi Hirishi is HPR's general assignment reporter. You can find a link to her story on the Conversation Facebook page or on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
You're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, a new way to manage marine conservation. But first, your quiz.
We take a look at the history of stadiums on this Aloha Friday. The Honolulu Stadium is well known throughout the state for being the main venue for sports, but today we are looking back at the Honolulu Stadium that was once located where we now see the old Stadium Park on the corner of King Street and Eisenberg. It was a ballpark constructed in 1925 and primarily served the Hawaii Baseball League and a new semi-pro baseball league. Once the stadium was officially completed in 1927, it quickly became a versatile venue that hosted not only baseball, but football and boxing games as well. In the 1930s, baseball teams from other countries, such as Japan and Korea, came to play at the Honolulu Stadium. And in 1933, Babe Ruth played an exhibition game. With all the excitement once centered around the stadium, we wanted to know the man responsible for its construction. He arrived in Honolulu in 1910 and soon after established the Oahu Baseball League and Oahu Service Athletic League. Do you know the name of the local businessman who purchased 14 acres and built the Honolulu Stadium? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Moyer Financial and Kaiser Permanente.
The state has created a new tool to gather public input on the state of Hawaii's oceans and on the condition of its coastal zones. It's an online tool called the Ocean Resources Management Plan Dashboard, and Program Manager Justine Nihipali hopes it will broaden public access to valuable information about the state of our ocean and give more people the opportunity to weigh in.
The goals for this project actually would be very long-standing. This is a public interface for the Ocean Resources Management Plan, and it provides information to the public and to our stakeholders as well as our decision makers about the implementation of the progress of the plan. Too often, plans get a bad rap for having a lot of work being put into the development of a plan and then sitting on a shelf. And so this dashboard is a way for us to demonstrate actual progress for implementation activities that contribute to furthering the goals of the plan.
Is the dashboard a more effective way to reach the public than the way you folks used to do it?
I'd like to think so, and I really hope so. The dashboard integrates a lot of visual elements, including images and videos, to better demonstrate and have a better public interface than a very text-heavy report than I think people have been typically used to from government agencies. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to better provide information to folks and then have it be a more digestible platform.
Make it accessible and therefore understandable.
Yeah, yeah, rather than combing through an 80-page report of 5 years of work.
Which would, and that 80-page report would likely only be combed through by people who were already kind of subject matter experts and had, had skin in the game, yeah?
If that, I think sometimes sometimes things don't get read, and you know, very selectively so. And so I'm hoping that, you know, being able to click through the goals and the measures that are demonstrated on this platform will be a good opportunity for the public to understand what our agencies are doing towards implementation and really where our progress is as well.
What are some of those categories, in which you're gathering public input?
Well, we have 11 management priorities under this plan, mm-hmm. and ranges from appropriate coastal development to coastal hazards and watersheds, to name a few. And part of how we're trying to gather public input is in 2018, which is actually this year, we'll be starting the update for the ORMP. And that's where the public will be able to provide us with input for the next iteration of the five-year cycle for this plan.
What do I, as a member of the public, wish that you had put more emphasis on, that kind of thing?
I think that the best way to describe it would be the public can let us know where their priorities are, where they think in their community and for these agencies under this framework of the ORMP, where they think we should focus on to the extent of the agency's capabilities.
Because I'm looking at some of your categories: appropriate coastal development, management mm-hmm. of coastal hazards, watershed management, marine resources. These are just some of a great many. So it really does drill down to quite a bit of detail, doesn't it?
It does. And I think what's unique about our plan, or this plan, is that it doesn't only focus on one agency's activities. It really tries to interconnect different agencies and their roles in order to accomplish some of those management priorities that you just mentioned, such as marine resources and watersheds. We know here in the state of Hawaii that, you know, nothing happens in a bubble. Nothing happens in just a silo. Everything is interconnected in terms of how we use our resources, how we develop, and those impacts on the environment. So I think that's what the value of the ORMP is, and it really shows the agencies that are involved and who the lead is and who are the partners that can help support those efforts.
What's at stake for somebody who is, not a daily visitor to the ocean, to the beach, but as, you know, a recreational paddler, kayaker? What's their stake in all this?
I think they can best share their feedback on what their challenges are and what they think the agencies are doing well, and help us to prioritize in our next iteration of the ORMP starting in 2018, where they want the agencies to focus their priorities.
Whether improving the health of the reef versus, promoting aquaculture. I'm just grabbing a couple of categories off what I see here.
Sure, sure. I think that's a good way of putting it. And then how? I think they're the ones that the users are the ones that are out there more often than some of us, than the agencies. And they can provide recommendations to how we can better interface with the public, and where they can provide more information to the agencies as well.
Justine, have you kind of had your druthers about where you would most like to hear from the public in which of the many subject matter areas? What do you think is maybe most valuable to you folks?
I don't think I can choose, actually. I think people have a wide variety of interests, and we've tried to capture those in the plan, as well as the respective roles and responsibilities of the state agencies that are involved throughout the state. So I don't think I can pick one or the other.
Fair enough.
So I would certainly encourage folks to take a look at the dashboard and look at where they're interested and where they have a perspective that would help us to further the plan, and check out where the agencies are going.
Well, you hit on something, though, Justine, which is that you would find out through this which state agencies pertain to the issue that is of concern to you, right?
Yes. Each of the 84 metrics in our plan is labeled on the dashboard with the agency that has the responsibility in that area. So we are trying to be as transparent as possible and realistic as possible with these metrics about where each agency is going and the progress that's been made over the last 5 years. And where should we go now in the next 5 years? You know, do we continue to focus on this area? And if we're having trouble accomplishing these metrics, then how do we improve upon that? Or is it still a realistic priority after 5 years? Have we made enough progress in that area? Or should we focus on another emerging issue?
Especially when you have all the other priority areas to weigh against it. When you say, is it a priority, you also have gathered in one place all the things to compare it to.
That's correct, yeah.
Justine Nihipali is Program Manager for the Hawaii Coastal Zone Management Program at the State Department of Planning. We have links to the Ocean Resources Management Plan dashboard and the management plan itself posted on the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Civil Beach Reality Check takes a closer look at recent drownings on Maui, 6 in the last 10 days. Two of the victims were wearing full face masks, focusing attention on whether there's something about the design that deserves a second look. Good morning, Nathan.
Good morning.
Now, you wrote about this a few months back, and I know we're talking about the ninja masks, right?
Yeah, well, there's several different brands of these full face masks, and they're kind of all over the board, but all have a fairly similar design.
Now, I've seen different types of snorkeling gear. You know, there's a head mount snorkel. I've seen swimmers out there with double snorkels, one snorkel on either side of the face. So why is this one so unusual?
Well, from what the different ocean safety experts I've talked to are saying, and they've even started to do some of their own tests, it's a couple different things. One is the potential for carbon dioxide to build up in the mask. And the other is the difficulty in removing it quickly in case of an emergency. And that's because the straps kind of sit below the back of the head and then also on the top of the head.
And so what about the thought that, okay, we're going to be seeing a lot more drownings relating to people in the water, just simply because we have a lot more people in the water with so many visitors that come every year. We just have record numbers. So it just stands to reason that we're going to see a lot more snorkeling deaths because there's more people in the water.
I think that holds true, absolutely. And so it becomes a question of, well, what are we going to do to up the public safety messaging, maybe more lifeguards on beaches? What are we going to do to try to help keep those numbers down as low as possible?
But right now, nobody tracks the type of snorkel gear that people use, though, right?
Well, actually, after my story, I think it was back in March, I did a big piece on the full-face masks after Guy Cooper, a man from California, his wife drowned on the Big Island, and she was wearing one of these, and he's convinced that it definitely played a role. And, you know, all we have are these anecdotal stories, but he's kind of taken it on himself as a kind of a crusade to raise awareness of these, get something done. And within a few months, he convinced some of the county and state officials to indeed start tracking what type of masks and what type of maybe even brands in some of the counties people are wearing when they have drowning incidents or near drowning incidents.
So is that in all the counties across the board or just certain ones?
It's in all four counties have agreed to do it. I'm a little unclear on how well it's being implemented across the board. I know Maui, for instance, it's only been in the past 5 months or so that they've had that data, and it's just difficult. And talking to different battalion chiefs, some say, you know, they're performing CPR, they're doing all these other things. It's going to take a little bit before they also remember, okay, wait, collect the mask, log the brand of it, the type, and all those extra little details that end up being really important in the long run.
What are we hearing from the manufacturers of these masks?
All the calls I've placed have not been returned, so really not much.
Oh, that's a big problem, huh? Okay, all
yes,
right.
Indeed.
Well, any other reporting that is going to be done? Is there going to be reporting to the legislature, or is it just to the councils? How does that all work?
You know, I haven't heard anything about the legislature taking it up, but, you know, they did just start a couple weeks ago, so it's still an option, I suppose.
All right. All right. Thank you, Nathan. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks. My pleasure.
That was Nathan Eagle with today's Reality Check from Civil Beat.
My name is Chris Friend-Rice. I'm the Director of Operations for Veterinary Emergency and Referral Center of Hawaii. Our favorite thing about being an underwriter for HPR is definitely the feeling that we are giving back to the community. In general, that's something that our business tries to do on a regular basis. Hawaii Public Radio, being something that we all listen to personally, was a natural choice for us to support that and give back.
Hawaii Public Radio Underwriting. Your message heard here.
Fridays on our show, we check in with our news department and with our news director, Bill Dorman. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning. Aloha, Chris.
So what are you folks working on? You're starting with a name that may be familiar.
Yeah, I know it's a name that's familiar to you and to a lot of our listeners as well. Fred Korematsu, as a lot of our listeners know, he challenged the legality of the internment of Japanese Americans in World War II. Mm-hmm. And the case of Korematsu versus the United States famously rose up to the level of the Supreme Court, which actually ruled in favor of the U.S. Now, mm-hmm. his conviction for refusing to report for internment, basically incarceration, mm-hmm. Was overturned. But the Supreme Court case never has been explicitly overturned. Mm-hmm. So the Fred Korematsu case and what it means is remembered each year in different ways. Next Tuesday is Fred Korematsu Day. It's recognized state of California, where he was born and raised, and Virginia as well. Would have been his 99th birthday. But they call it Fred Korematsu Day of Civil Liberties and the Constitution, which if you think about sort of the state of immigration policy right now, mm-hmm. the debate about immigration in the United States, mm-hmm. pretty interesting time to, you know, they sent immigration authorities pretty recently to a bunch of 7-Elevens around the country, basically looking for illegal
wow.
immigrants. And so it's within this atmosphere. Noe Tanigawa is going to take a look at, again, revisiting the Fred Korematsu story a bit, but also making those ties to sort of the current day and immigration policy.
Well, you know, there's also another area, which is civil disobedience. This was an act of
exactly.
civil disobedience
mm-hmm.
in a country whose very existence is an act of civil disobedience.
You know, the ironies of history and how yeah. history is remembered spottily in some cases
exactly.
is, pretty remarkable.
Nation of rebels.
Yes, exactly.
And you've got a story on bail reform.
Yeah, and I know this is an issue that's going to come up on the show next week with a guest as well, but also topic of a news piece. National issue, certainly, coming very much into play here in Hawaii. The basic idea of bail, as you know, comes from the Constitution. Any defendant presumed innocent until proven guilty.
Right.
And while you're waiting for that trial, the mechanism of bail, financial bond in exchange for being released. But if you can't afford it, you remain incarcerated.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's that basic fairness issue and what can be done to improve it. And taking a look very specifically in terms of Hawaii, what bail reform might mean for overcrowding of jails here, because that's, you know, people talk about prison, which is when people are sentenced.
After the conviction.
After the conviction, exactly. But waiting around for trial in jail, that's a significant portion of the population.
That'll be a good one to dig into. And then the legislature is taking a look at education, not for the first time.
Yeah, right. Kuvehi, by the way, is going to be doing the bail reform piece, I should mention. And yeah, the legislature looking at public education attention, of course, on several levels. But as Wayne Yoshioka points out, Superintendent Kishimoto is going to be testifying with a focus on recruitment retention of teachers. Again, a familiar topic, mm-hmm. but likely to get some updated information on that moving target of the state of teacher shortage in the state of Hawaii.
We're going to want to take a look at that. Thanks a lot, Bill.
You bet.
Bill Dorman is HPR's news director. This is The Conversation on HPR One, and following yesterday's panel discussion of education in Hawaii, we had some calls on our talkback line.
My name is Deedon Brown. I'm calling from Wahiwa on Oahu. My comment is that the world that our kids in school today are going to be living in is very, very different from the world we're living in now, or the world that the teachers are living in now. I think the important part of education is to teach kids to think, so that they will be able to find their own way in the future. And one of the ways they do it is through creative arts, as well as the sciences and math and all the other subjects that are being taught. A well-rounded person is one who can think and solve problems more readily than somebody who's focused in just a limited direction. That's my comment. Thank you.
Aloha. My name is Joan Kretkoviak. I myself, born and raised on Oahu, I'm a Kailua High graduate of 1974, and there were different tracks. There was an academic track for kids that were college-bound, and there was more of a vocational track for kids that were not college-bound, and that included getting part-time jobs with a program called Community Quest. We had the Madrigals. We had an amazing agricultural program, and I have to say my high school experience was top drawer. And the program, I think, lasted for another year and I think was done away with in 1976. And then they went back to the regular six classes a day, et cetera, et cetera. Fast forward, I am now a clinical social worker licensed in the state of Hawaii, and I also am a part-time substitute teacher. And I find big challenges with the curriculum and the No Child Left Behind and kids not learning social skills and social studies and current events. I really firmly believe that our children and our youth, our keiki are not the future. Our keiki are the now. Aloha and mahalo nui loa for such a great show.
Another listener, Daniel Laraway, wrote in after hearing Noe Tanigawa's interview with a group called Proud Boys that has set up a chapter here in Hawaii. It has ties to an alt-right movement. Now, he wrote, Noe Tanigawa's UH interviews were fascinating. As a guy from the mainland who has spent most of my life here, I'm grateful for Hawaii and respect people here. That said, I've been beaten up totally out of the blue because of my undeniable helliness and know of many others who have experienced the same thing. I don't compare myself to discrimination in the U.S. or Hawaiian history, but I have certainly gotten a taste of it here as a white male. I generally disagree with the Proud Boys. I encourage them to remain civil and nonviolent, of course, but I respect their right to exist and their right to free speech and so on. If possible, we must all try to find more common ground for the common good. Both UH interviews would have been incomplete without the other. Thanks for two really good interviews.
You can find those reports by Noe Tanigawa on her Arts and Culture page on hawaiipublicradio.org.
The The wetlands in Kailua are home to many native birds, and for decades there's been talk about doing more to protect the Kauai Nui Hamakua Marsh. The master plan has evolved over the years with lots of input from community groups, but there are some residents who don't feel assured that the Department of Land and Natural Resources has the resources to properly manage the area. Some in the community who've been vocal about the changing character of the beach town worry that the plan will draw even more tourists to the area. DLNR held a recent community meeting to get more feedback and to clarify any misconceptions people might have. Oahu Wildlife Manager Jason Misaki sat down with us to talk about the next steps. He says the department is focused on scientific research, conservation management, and subsistent and traditional practices by Native Hawaiians to guide its plan.
You know, if you look at the plan and the draft EIS, really what that represents is the sort of the maximum buildup that we're looking at as far as implementing our programs within Kauai Nui and Hamakua. And, you know, honestly, there's still a lot of work to get to the point of the maximum buildup and of the point of the details in which the plan is laying out as far as the number of buildings and the number of things that we're putting out there, which is, you know, a topic that has come up a number of times throughout the meetings. But ultimately, we want to lay out the foundation on what we see as an appropriate use of the lands. And again, in speaking in terms of the three basic functions of how we want to protect it, is we have an idea, and we're experts on how we want to manage the natural resources, the wetland restoration portion, the ecosystem for endangered species and water birds, and the flood control. The rest of the areas that kind of have been coming up are really less than 10% of the total area. And that part of it, we worked directly with the community and with groups and with people that have already been working out there to establish an appropriate usage of that area based on subsistence, traditional, and customary practices by Native Hawaiians. And so we wanted to very much focus that on community groups and stewards of the land.
For our listeners who may not know, the plan really covers less than 1,000 acres, like 986 acres. And the plan that you folks have to develop this educational center on is really on just 10 acres on the perimeter of the property, correct?
Yes, it's a small portion of the overall picture.
There's been some concern by members in the community that, you know, the plan will encourage commercialism of the area, and what's the department's response to that?
We're not looking at doing commercial activity within this, within the area that we're talking about, as far as public access, yeah? So the less than 10% of the areas I was referring to where, you know, the proposed cultural center, the proposed sites for the different groups will be there. The focus will be that every permit or every activity that we allow with these community groups, with these stewards, is based on natural resource management, education, and sort of cultural practices. And so that's where we want to focus the effort on, and that's what we want to promote as part of us allowing stewards to be part of the land and to have a space at Kauai Nui.
Now, the area has long been neglected. There's been lots of discussion about pollution, about, you know, aeration of the area. You've got all the streams, you know, coming in, feeding into the marsh. You know, there may be runoff from industrial areas nearby. But your mission is to really protect the resource. And I know there is a segment of the community that, at looking at this plan at first blush, they're thinking, well, no, the plans are too large and you're going to destroy a resource. But that's not your intent.
It's not our intent. And, you know, it's been a long time coming developing this plan. And even before we started the process of updating and going through this process, I mean, we've been trying to address the issue of managing Kauai Nui as a wetland ecosystem for a long time. And so our mission is to protect it, is to enhance the native species there and also enhance the ecosystem function. So, you know, all of the actions and all of the activities we're doing are specific to creating a better environment than what's there. And that's kind of what makes this draft environmental impact statement very important to us. It allows us to approach it from a vetted compliance standpoint so that we're able to implement proper programs to ensure that we're able to facilitate the restoration and rehabilitation of the land and its resources.
What has the department done to modify the plan?
A lot of the feedback was valid, and that's what triggered a lot of the changes in there. And what we wanted to do is focus on the areas that were to stay consistent with what we were communicating as far as our plan to address the resources and our plan to address the our ability to allow stewards to run programs on parts of our land that we've identified as not sensitive as far as wetland, for wetland ecosystems or endangered species.
Right now, there is an area for the folks that operate remote control airplanes. I know drone operators have gone there to learn how to use drones. So there are areas of Kapa'a Quarry and, you know, that the backside that the community really uses, and probably they're worried about the impact on those areas. What can you say about that?
We don't plan to do any modifications on those lands. We don't control those lands. What this will do is it'll create a system of transparency where we're saying, hey, here's our long-term vision for what we want to do in this area, and should we put together something that's going to jeopardize their operations, we can start the conversation of how we can adjust our deployment of our strategy or our tactics in order to ensure that they're able to utilize that the land, the airplane park, and other areas as it was intended to use.
And Kapa'a Quarry Road, is that a city road?
I believe there's a city easement over it, but it's a private road. I'm not 100% sure about that.
Oh, interesting. All right, because I wasn't sure how DLNR's plans to restore the marsh affects that road, because it is heavily traveled with refuse trucks and people dumping rubbish at the refuse center there. And it's kind of a narrow road, and
yeah,
a lot of people do traverse that area at a very high rate of speed. Have you had much discussion at all with the city about access points along that road?
Not specifically. The draft EIS does look at the traffic flow, and there is a traffic study in there, and I don't know the exact details of it. But, you know, ultimately, when this plan is moved forward and when we get it finalized, it basically gives the neighboring landowners, the neighboring managing entities, kind of an idea of what we're doing. And that starts that conversation of how we can properly manage it, right? Hey, we have this in our plan that we wanna have a education center or have some kind of cultural land use here. How does that, as we put that plan and that project together, how do we work with these different landowners, these different access point managers or land managers? How do we work with them to ensure that we're not going to negatively affect the neighboring lands, or how do we work in a way that we can create a smooth transition between what we want to do and what's already occurring? And so, you know, we want to be responsible landowners, and this plan kind of puts it out there and what we want to do and how we can work with the neighboring landowners to ensure that it works.
Okay, Jason. Well, thank you. We appreciate your time
Okay. And
sharing the information, and look forward to the EIS and more public input.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Jason Misaki, who's the Oahu Wildlife Manager for DLNR's Division of Forestry and Wildlife. It's in response to community fears about commercialism of the marsh, which the state says is not their intent. You can find a copy of the proposed master plan for Kailua's Kauainui Marsh on the Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org. In today's quiz, we look back at the history of Old Stadium Park, where the Honolulu Stadium once stood. The 26,000-seat stadium was often filled to capacity for the different sports activities it hosted. And through its years of service, the venue saw hundreds flock to their seats to watch the greats like Babe Ruth, Mickey Mantle, and Jackie Robinson play the field. After World War II, major teams like the Brooklyn Dodgers and the New York Giants played, and exhibition games that left the crowd starry-eyed and wanting more. Even musicians paid visits to the stadium in its heyday. In 1957, Elvis Presley brought the precursor to his Aloha from Hawaii concert to Honolulu Stadium. However, all things do come to an end, and toward the end of its life, it was dubbed the nickname Termite Palace, after a termite infestation ate away at its foundation. It was torn down in 1976. Today, we're looking for the man who was responsible for the construction of the stadium. If you guess J. Ashman Bevan, then you guess right. He was the creator and general manager of the beloved Honolulu Stadium from 1925 to 1939. That is today's quiz, and if you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, hosting its annual literacy conference January 29th through February 1st on Maui, Oahu, Hawaii Island, and Kauai. Achieve3000/community/events.
Western cultures have a long tradition of celebrating their history through historic preservation, a practice that tends to marginalize the contributions of Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Island populations. A forum this weekend at the East-West Center with the topic Identity and Place, Celebrating Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander Heritage in the Hawaiian Islands, hopes to alter that imbalance. And as Maynette Benham, Chancellor of UH West Oahu, told me yesterday, organizers are recruiting Hawaii high school students to tell their stories on video.
The forum that we're holding is really giving an opportunity for community members, and in particular because we've added the youth voice to the forum, give folks an opportunity to talk about how place, how where they live, the paiaina in which we exist, how that really defines who they are and what their responsibilities are.
With a goal toward naming additional historic sites, is that right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And getting the youth component into this conversation is really important because they have much to learn and they have much to offer. And, you know, as we all begin to age, it's really important to know that when we're looking back, we have a lot of young people who will continue to look for those historic landmarks and preserve it because it's just part of our lineage, right?
What would be an example of one, Maynette?
Well, we are looking at Honouliuli, of course, right, which is now part of the National Park Service that's connected to UH West Oahu.
Mm-hmm.
And we're actually running quite a bit of programming for our high school students to really learn about the history of that place. And many students who come to us, they have ancestors who were interned there.
Mm-hmm.
And these are histories and stories that they may have never learned, but it's also very relevant stories for the political situation we're in today, and it just gives students some sense of, you know, connecting historical events to current events and why they should know about this and why Honouliuli is important, and what they can do around immigration tensions in our community today.
One of the things that Honouliuli reminds us of is that not all of our history is particularly flattering to us.
No, absolutely not. And I think our high school students that we're working with through the Sea Rider Production partnership truly understand, you know, the complications of our history on this land. And as young people are really trying to figure it out, what does it mean to them? There are some of the digital videos that these youth have produced that will be shown and talked about,
mm-hmm.
which really does take a look at the complications they face around conservation, preservation, economic development, homelessness, health and well-being. You know, how do they understand those issues and still malama the place and historic landmarks?
But the whole idea of narratives that are underrepresented or have been underrepresented in
mm-hmm.
the past, why have they been underrepresented?
Well, they have been underrepresented in more of a public, I'd say, a public venue. They have not been underrepresented around the campfires in our communities, in smaller enclaves, where
mm-hmm.
we tell our stories often as a way of teaching generations, you know, our next generation of young people. I think it's never been something that has been part of the master narrative around the public narrative,
mm-hmm.
not it's because people have not thought of it as being relevant. But I think today, because we all know that diversity just makes us stronger, there's a real need and a real desire for folks who want to learn about each other and each other's stories, right? That's what I think.
I'm intrigued by your use of the term master narrative, but it kind of addresses the whole idea that history is written by the victors and that people in charge tend to preserve their history more avidly than those who are not.
That's right. That's right. But, you know, I do want to go back to the mo'olelo of these places that these young people represent. You know, in school, they're taught the narratives of the ruling class, mm-hmm. so to say, right? But at home and in their communities, they're taught the mo'olelo of the place, of their families, whether, you know, it's a story of immigration from the Philippines or from the Pacific Islands or from, you know, other Asian-derived, you know, places. They learn those stories. And I think what we're trying to do in this partnership is to really elevate those stories as being vibrant places to locate knowledge and action and really show the importance of those diversities and how these kids have really been able to share these stories with one another to really attend to some really, you know, knotty issues about historic preservation, about landmarks.
Minette, when you say that they're, you kind of said in effect that they're still being taught the what you referred to as the master narrative in schools. Do you think that's diminishing?
I think there's a place, all things in balance. There is a place for the teaching of a variety of different perspectives of history. Mm-hmm. But there has been a long time in our schools of teaching one particular perspective. And I think now we're beginning to turn the corner and beginning to value different perspectives, mm-hmm. Whether it's historical perspectives, political perspectives, scientific perspectives. I think we are turning that corner and unlocking the door for students to really try to figure out, you know, sort of where, you know, what knowledge context or what knowledge wells they're going to draw on to answer today's problems. You know, with technology, and that's, you know, we're showing a sense of place and identity and culture through digital video mm-hmm. because they have access to a breadth of technology and information that, you know, neither you or I really had when we were at that age, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. I think schools are beginning to say, hey, they got access, right? So our job is to really help them to critically view these different perspectives because it's at their fingertips, right?
Well, the tools you describe as being now at their fingertips, the whole being able to shoot and edit video and create video narratives, it kind of not everything has to become a text document.
So that's right.
It's becoming a different avenue of expression and learning.
That's right. You know, and what's wonderful about the videos that are going to be presented is that there's poetry woven into it. There are interviews of real, you know, salt of the earth community leaders and community workers and moms and dads. There is beauty in the photography. That's the landscape that's being shot. And there's just real critical commentary about some of the problems that these young people are seeing in their place, how they're learning about their place, and how they're feeling responsible for their community. So all of those critical skills that we're looking for our schools to teach, I think, are coming together through the advent of digital video.
Sounds as if information is being gathered that really hasn't been gathered in such a comprehensive way before.
Yeah, very systems perspective of teaching, isn't it? So I think it's really exciting that kids are really taking a look at multiple systems in our communities and trying to, you know, determine the relationships of how things work together or don't work together. It's a very different mindset. And a very different way to look at the world and walk in the world.
Think it can change the world?
I'm banking on it.
Maynette Benham is the chancellor of UH West Oahu. She's part of a two-day forum at the East-West Center on Identity and Place, celebrating Asian American, Native Hawaiian, and Pacific Islander heritage in the Hawaiian Islands. There's a screening this evening at 5 p.m. of videos made by 11th and 12th grade students enrolled in Waianae High School's Sea Rider Productions video production program. You can learn more about the event today and tomorrow on the Conversation's Facebook page.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to the St. Andrews Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
Swing to the Latin and salsa rhythms of Freddie Miranda Jr., drummer and percussionist extraordinaire, and his quintet of all-stars. Make your reservations today for their Atherton studio debut on January 27th. Call 955-8821 during business hours or go to hprtickets.org for the Freddie Miranda Jr. Quintet. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
And that's it for this week. Coming up next week on The Conversation, we'll meet former Japanese Ambassador Ichido Fukasaki here for the Walk in U.S. Talk on Japan program.
We'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's a number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. You can also find us on Instagram at The Conversation HPR.
Our program is produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finnerty, and Amber Kahn. Our intern is Emily Cardinale.
The Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Catherine Cruz.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us Monday and pick up The Conversation.